Welcome to the South Fellowship Church podcast. Here at South Fellowship, we exist to help people live in the way of Jesus with the heart of Jesus. Wherever you're listening from today, we hope you're encouraged by this week's message.
Well, good morning, friends. It almost makes me ready for a hoedown, which is about as close as an Englishman ever gets to hoedowning. It is not in our people's blood, dancing in general, in actual fact. My name's Alex, I'm one of the pastors here. If you're visiting this Easter, it's so good to have you here. I'm going to start by reading us a passage. This passage is a celebration. Are you ready for this? Luke 24, verse 1 through 5. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. The men were playing golf. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood before them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is risen." Let me read that to you again for a second, because I'm not sure you got it. Why do you look for the living amongst the dead? He is risen. This is good news. This is good news. Why do you look for the living amongst the dead? He is not here. He is risen. Today we come together to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. We come to celebrate what some people have called the greatest story ever told. If you aren't convinced, then, well, Hollywood said it as well in their own way. In not a great way, to be honest. Not the best Jesus on screen, but this has been called the greatest story ever told for multiple reasons. Multiple reasons being that the death and resurrection of Jesus brings new life. The resurrection of Jesus is the trampling over death. If you were in the Eastern Orthodox Church, right now we would be saying over and over again something like this: Christ has risen from the dead, trampling over death by death, and on those in the tombs bestowing life. That is news that you will need at some point, and people you love will need at some point. There are all sorts of reasons we might pull out. The story of Jesus spread quickly, and some people have argued on a sociological level, it spread quickly because it was better than the other stories out there. Certainly the idea of life eternal was better than the story of atheism of the day. But I would suggest this right off the bat as a kind of thesis for the day. The story of Jesus is the greatest story ever told because it impacts every other story. It impacts every other story. Stories are important. The writer Maya Angelou said this: we tell ourselves stories in order to live. You have a story. Perhaps you have a story about how you met a spouse or a loved one. Perhaps you have a story about kids. Perhaps you have a family story, the family that you grew up in. Somewhere you have an individual story. Perhaps your story is about success. Perhaps your story is about failure. Perhaps your story is about love. Perhaps it's the absence of love. But somewhere you have a story. And somewhere nations have stories as well. America has a story. It has a history. The country I come from, Britain, has a story. I've often said that the story of Britain is great plans spoiled by overcast weather and the probability of rain to come. That's like we tell ourselves something about who we are and the background we come from. But sometimes stories, well, the hardest part is how to finish them. How many of you, if you were honest, would own to struggling to finishing your stories? If you don't spend time with a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, or a 9-year-old, this will tell you everything that you need to know. There's meandering stories that go on all sorts of journeys, and they feel like they're going somewhere, but they don't seem to come to a conclusion. Some of the stories we tell look something like this. They start off great, and then the end just feels thrown together. Some sermons feel like that. As well. I was once flying into Haiti, and about 500 yards from the ground, we were pulled up and had to circle at about 10,000 feet for a bunch of time. And I thought, you know what? This is like some sermons I've heard. This is like some sermons I've delivered as well. They just never seem to conclude. In actual fact, some great books finish that way as well. The author just can't bring his character to resolution. And yet today we look at texts that have a special problem. The four writers of the gospel narratives, if you're kind of unfamiliar with church, then the four biographies of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they have this particular challenge when they come to their conclusion. And we'll look at them briefly. The narratives have the challenge of writing an end for a story that is far from over. A story centered around a main character who is far from dead, but who is no longer physically present. When they write, the church has continued, its story is growing and it is spreading all over the world, but Jesus is no longer physically present with them. He's still the centerpiece of the story, and they're trying to conclude his life on earth story in these biographies, but there's still like so much more to come. So they all approach that in their own specific ways. Matthew, the first biography, approaches it like this. And then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you to the very end of the age." The story speaks about future promise and Jesus' presence, albeit invisible, with them. Mark, the second biography, has a similar approach. After the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and sat at the right hand of God. Then the disciples went out and preached everywhere, and the Lord worked with them and confirmed his word by the signs that accompanied it. Luke is the only one that has a sequel. He has an advantage. When you're writing a sequel, you always get to end a little bit more vaguely. But he says this: when he had led them out to the vicinity of Bethany, he lifted up his hands and blessed them. While he was blessing them, he left them and was taken up into heaven. Then they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and they stayed continually at the temple praising God. The first three choose to focus on the fact that the story is continuing. It's going somewhere else, even though Jesus is no longer present. John chooses a different tack. This is how John concludes in chapter 21. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would have been written. John talks about the scope of what Jesus has done. If you're wrestling with faith and unsure if Jesus is who you want to follow, a recommendation I would have for you is read John's gospel. He does this amazing job of recognizing the fact that Jesus is constantly surrounded by people, surrounded by crowds. But somehow, wonderfully, in these moments, Jesus manages to allow everybody else to fade out. And his gospel is full of one-on-one encounters that Jesus seems to have with particular people. He seems to bring constantly new beginnings out of old stories for the people that he encounters. And John says at the end of his narrative, if you were to take those stories and you were to add them up and write books about them, well, the whole world wouldn't contain the books that would be written. It was this passage that gave us the inspiration for some of the decoration you see around us. We wanted to gather lots of books and put them in lots of places and connect them to the idea of what Jesus did and the life that he brings to us. But even the books we've managed to gather, they don't tell the story. Doesn't matter how many books you gather. We took some inspiration from the places that I live and the books that I gather around me. Every place that I sit and do life in just has stacks and piles of books. I have a wife that has suffered long and hard because of this passion to continue to gather books. My parents have also suffered long and hard because some of them are still about 6,000 miles away. But even those books, even this library shop that we have behind us that goes on and on and on, it doesn't encapsulate every story that Jesus has encountered, every story that Jesus has impacted. And many of you in the room would say, I am one of those people. Even at the end of his writing, John is obsessed almost, is caught up with the idea that Jesus brings new beginnings out of old stories. Even if in his ending, John is focused on new beginnings, recollecting in his own mind perhaps the number of times that he has seen Jesus encounter someone in a moment where they seem particularly lost, particularly unsure of the journey ahead, and Jesus makes a difference. And so when he ends in John chapter 21, it seems he ends there, or even extends his ending, because he wants to wrap up one particular story that still seems to be floating, still seems to have a loose end. So to get there, let's just look at his resurrection account, which in itself is full of all these fascinating details that perhaps the other writers don't have. John 20 verse 1 says this: early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. The version in Luke we just read earlier said a bunch of women went, maybe two, maybe three, but John remembers particularly that Mary encountered Jesus in that moment. So she came running to, let's go back a second. Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. Right now, there is no resurrection in this story. Right now, it seems like the body of Jesus has gone missing. That seems like an insult, seems like a heartache in a Jewish culture that valued the preservation of a body. Mary comes to let Peter and John, called the other disciple here, because he wrote it, know that. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter. One of my absolute favorite moments in the biblical text. It's so middle school, it's just delightful. It's so like just human. It's just a personality coming out. John, writing his book, says it's important to me that when you go away, you remember that I'm faster than Peter. If you have doubts about anything else, don't have doubts about that. Both were running. But the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. That tells you everything you need to know about Peter. He was braver, but remember, John was faster, just in case you forgot that important detail. He saw the strips of linen there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Suddenly, what they see no longer looks like a body has been stolen or removed. It looks like something has happened. Who would take a body and remove the linen cloths around it? There's something now that's unusual to this story. This is the first rumor of resurrection that begins in John's gospel. For a moment in time, Jesus was safely dead and his story was ended. And now the beginning of this greater story begins to emerge. The other disciple who had reached the tomb first, because he was faster, also went inside. He saw and believed. John has this moment where he sees the cloths from the burial lying there and he believes. But what about Peter? What about his story? Does Peter believe yet? Peter's been on a journey. He's proudly proclaimed a few days earlier that if everyone else betrays Jesus, he will be faithful. And then he's failed to live up to his promise. Can he believe in the resurrection at this moment? John believed. But what about Peter? Where does his story end? Jesus appears to his disciples twice, and there's no real mention of Peter. He's present, we know, but there's never this moment where Peter comes and he has this restoration moment with Jesus. Here's the story that still continues to lurk. He denied Jesus three times. He ran away when he said he wouldn't, and it seems like his story has taken a tragic turn along with his rabbi. In John 21, this is what we read. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and the two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter said. To us, that seems like a nothing statement. It seems like, he's going to do a hobby, right? He's going to do something relaxing. And yet, to Peter, in his culture and with his background, this means something. Peter was a fisherman when Jesus found him. And Jesus told him that he could be something more than a fisherman. His message to Peter was this: Peter, come with me, and no longer will you catch fish that are alive and will become dead. Now we'll catch humans, people, and they'll be dead, but then they'll come alive. He offers Peter this story that was never going to be Peter's story. Peter was the guy that was kicked out of class early, the guy that was never going to amount to anything, the guy that was going to take over his father's business. But in a culture that prized religious education and becoming a rabbi one day, Peter was a no on that score. Jesus had almost convinced Peter that Peter could be something else. And now there's this moment of Jesus' death. And it seems to all the world that Jesus was wrong about Jesus. And if Jesus was wrong about Jesus, then that means Jesus was wrong about Peter too. All of the things that Jesus told him, all of the hopes that were created for him, they're now suddenly, they don't mean anything. They're nothing. They're more myths than truths. They were just nice ideas that no longer kind of stand up to his experience. They were like fishermen's tales. Every year, my wife and kids and I, we go up fishing to some of her family's lake house up in Minnesota. And I went up there, and her grandfather was there, and I was the new grandfather-in-law, grandson-in-law, or whatever the term is. So I wanted to make a good impression. And so he was showing me his wall of fish. And I said, "What do you have to do to get up on that wall? What's missing from your wall?" And he said, "Well, I've got these great fish that people have caught over the years, but what I really want is like a big pike that would go across the bottom." And I looked at him and said, "I'm going out, I'm going to catch that fish for you. How big does it need to be?" And he said, "About 32 inches. And so I went out and I pulled in this 33-inch pike that's in my hands right there. And I proudly carried it back on the line to him to show him that he now had the missing piece from this wall, and I could be the favorite grandson-in-law, or at least in the reckoning. And he looked at this fish and he said, "It's not big enough." And I said, "They never are they? Fish just aren't big enough." I was still proud of this, and I sent it to a friend, and I said, "Look at this fish I caught." And he said, "That's great. This was the one we caught just the other day." And another friend in the group said, "Oh, that's really good. This was the one I caught just before that." The story of fish is that they're never quite big enough. And so you have these fishermen's tales. They stretch the truth. They make the story grander and grander and grander. That is, I would suggest, where Peter is living right now. He is living in this moment where Jesus' stories, the things that he told Peter about him and the things he told Peter about Peter, at this point, they're no more than good fishermen's tales. They're myths. So much is Peter broken over this that he goes back to that old life. He finds himself a couple of hundred miles away after a five-day journey, back fishing where he grew up fishing, back potentially working in his father's business. And then we get this. Early in the morning, it's always early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" No, they answered. And if you've read the gospel accounts, you know this is not a brand new story. This is a story that we've heard at some point before. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, I'm faster than you. No, he didn't say that. He said, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and he jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the full net of fish, for they were not far from the shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have caught. So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat, dragged the net ashore. It was full of fish, 153, a life-changing catch of fish for the second time in Peter's life. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Being resurrected leaves you with a heck of an appetite. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Three denials from Peter, three resurrection appearances to the disciples, and now the conversation. A moment where the wayward disciple is invited to go for a walk with his master. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? A few days earlier, Peter had proudly proclaimed that he did love Jesus more than anybody else loved him. Can he say the same now after his failure? He can't. He just says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Twice more, Jesus asks him the question. And we read this. Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? Three denials from Peter, three resurrection appearances, and now three questions. And finally, Peter's moment of surrender. Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Peter comes to some peace with who he has been, and his faith that Jesus is who Jesus said he is, and that Peter may again be who Jesus said he could be, is restored. Frederick Buechner says this about encounters with Jesus. He says, and now, brothers, I will ask you a terrible question, and God knows I ask it of myself. Is the truth beyond all truths, beyond the stars, just this? That to live without him is the real death. That to die with him is the only life. That's the place that Peter lands. I said at the beginning that the Jesus story is the greatest story because it impacts every other story, but I feel like there's a word missing from that statement. I feel like there's something I'd like to add, and it's this word, potentially. Not that the Jesus story is potentially the greatest story. I think it is. It's the story that I live by, but I think it has the potential to impact every other story. And just like with Peter, that part's kind of on us. The Jesus story has this beautiful potential to impact every other story if we'll allow it to. And yet the thing I've figured living with myself for a bunch of years, which is just as terrible as you'd imagine, and working with so many people is that it's hard to let go of what you know. It's hard to let go of the person that you've been told that you are. It's hard to let go of the failures that you've experienced. Hard to let go of the narrative, the personal story, the story that says maybe you'll always be that way. The story that says you've tried this before and it didn't work. The story that says no one will ever really love you and accept you for who you are, the story that you've told over and over again, that you'll only amount to this thing, that no one in your family has achieved anything, and why would you? It's hard to let go of those stories. Hard to let go of maybe the story of origin, the thing that comes back to us time and time again. And yet, just like he came to Peter, Jesus comes to us and offers something more. Stephen James says this, that the gifts of the Master are these: freedom, life, hope, new direction, transformation, and intimacy with God. If the cross was the end of the story, we would have no hope. But the cross isn't the end. Jesus didn't escape from death, he conquered it and opened the way to heaven for all who would dare to believe. The moment of this truth, if we let it sweep over us, is stunning. It means Jesus really is who he claimed to be. We are really as lost as he said we are, and he really is the only way for us to intimately and spiritually connect with God again. Finally, Peter gets over the sense that he knows better about himself than Jesus does. He begins again to believe what Jesus says about him. And John's gospel is full of those moments where people in the worst spaces, in the spaces that they could never change, find transformation in Jesus. And we wanted to share a story just like that with you. And so this is Kim to share some of her story.
Hi, my name is Kim. I've been coming to South Fellowship for, I would say, about maybe 8 years now. My story is typical of any Easter story because it starts out in a dark place. It starts out with lament. I suffered with depression for most of all my 20s and half of my 30s. And along with that depression, I had a lot of suicidal thinking. And so I was in a very dark place of lament. I can feel it. My heart no longer pumps. My lungs no longer hold air. My muscles are all cramped up and can no longer move. My bones still feel strong, but even they can hardly wait to die. I'm just an empty shell filled with lost dreams and ambitions. The wind blows through my body freely now. There is nothing inside me anymore, and my cries are nothing but the howls of lost winds stuck in this empty cave called my body. That was my prayer of pain, my lament. And I'm so glad I dated it because I wrote it in February, and I was unaware that Easter was just around the corner, and I was a school teacher at the time. And I had a fourth grade classroom, and there was a little boy in that classroom named Daniel. And Daniel came up to me and he said, "Miss Bigot, would you go to church with me on Easter Sunday and hear my daddy preach?" And I could not tell this kid no. He was one of my favorite students, and I was like, "Okay, I will go to church with you on Easter Sunday." I hadn't been to church in over 15 years. The weekend of Easter was difficult, challenging. I wasn't in a good place. I got in a huge fight with my husband on Saturday morning, and I was all alone in my house. The darkness just came in, and I sat at the table and I thought, this is it. This is it. I looked over in the kitchen and I saw a knife set, and I thought, this is going to happen now. I cannot live another day. I can't do this. I knew that this was the perfect moment, and I knew exactly how I was going to do it. And then I heard God say to me, "Kim, what about Daniel? Daniel was going to be at church, and he was waiting for his teacher, and if I didn't show, I just couldn't imagine how devastating that would be." So I woke up the next day, I went to church, I walked in, and there was Daniel with his mom, just as happy as could be to see his teacher. The music started. And it was like coming up out of the deep end of a pool and getting a big breath of air. And I was like, what is happening? The darkness around me started to just chip away and chip away. I know in my heart, God said to me, "Kim, you don't need to die. My son already did that for you." He said, "I'm not a God of death. I'm a God of life." He changed my story. And God began to just heal my whole family. A young boy asked me to go to Easter, to go to church on Easter. I did, and God completely changed that story. I just look back and think, wow, from where I was, God completely changed the outcome of my story. And my story was not about death, but his story was of life. And I choose life.
I love that story. love how Peter's story and Kim's story align. They're both people that found ways to kind of escape. Peter finds a fishing boat, and you may have found a way too. You may have found your own place. May not be a fishing boat, maybe something else. But it's a place that allows you to say, you know what, this story doesn't change. It always finishes here, and it always will. The invitation to you this Easter is this. It's to allow Jesus to transform your story. Maybe not today, maybe in your future, but to stay close to Jesus, to keep pursuing that real transformation that comes from following him. Sometimes we settle for that pseudo transformation, says we've said a prayer, or we've attended a service or something like that. And yet that it seems the invitation of Jesus is to real change, to lasting change, to something more. Wherever you came in today, the invitation for you is not to join a church. It's definitely not to join this church. It's to simply to look again at Jesus, to allow his work and his message to begin to transform you. The one question I have for us this Easter, for each of us, for me included, is will you let God lead your story into a new beginning this Easter? Will you allow your small story with all of its weird quirks and turns to be immersed in this big story of Jesus that is the greatest story ever told? Maybe you've convinced yourself that your story is unique. And the kind of bad news is, well, no, you're unique. Your story probably isn't. It's probably other people that have been through similar things. And yet wherever you find yourself, your invite is there, that there's no story that Jesus can't transform. In a moment, Aaron and the team are gonna lead us, and we're gonna sing that story before we close, but I'm gonna lead us in a short prayer. And my invitation to you is to pray as well. In your own words, you get to speak to the God of the universe. You don't need to tell anybody, you don't need to put up a hand or do an altar call walk or any of those things. You just need to have a conversation, to own some of the ways that you've gone fishing. You found spaces to avoid that transformation. You stop believing Jesus is who he is, maybe. You certainly stop believing you can be anything more than you are. And the invitation is simply to say, Jesus, in the places that I hide, would you find me and transform this heart? Jesus, you know each of us in the room. Those of us that find ourselves in these seats on Easter and maybe on Christmas. Those of us that sit here week after week and someone else is in our seat today, and that's a problem. You know our hearts. You know our needs for transformation. Please speak to each person. Lead us into new beginnings. Amen.
If you've been touched by this ministry and you want that to spread to others, you might consider partnering with us financially. You can give online at southfellowship.org/give. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of your day.